Hey friends, welcome to the Victor Marks Podcast with Victor Marks, founder of All Things Possible Ministries. Welcome to the show where we bring you real conversations faced with life's hard truths, stories of redemption, and the latest from the front lines. Whether you're on the road, getting your day started, or finally settling in, we've got an exciting new episode planned for you. So let's dive in to today's show.
Hello and welcome back to part two of this interview between myself, Jeff Teagues, and Chuck Holton. I am the Chief Operations Officer here at All Things Possible Ministries, and dare I be so bold to say, Victor's right-hand man. Together, as friends and colleagues, both with military backgrounds, Victor and I have been a part of some very impactful missions over the years, and another unsung hero who's often working behind the scenes and often is there before we even get on the ground is an old friend, Chuck Holton. If you were unable to listen to yesterday's interview, you're going to want to dig that up because we're going to pick up where we left off. And Chuck, you still have me reeling a day later from these statistics that you started with, which is you are personally seeing that in this group of people that you're following on this journey to the United States, that one in seven is dying in route.
So we have been following one particular group of extracontinental migrants as they make their way up from South America across the Darien Gap in Panama into Central America. And of that group, one in seven has died. We've seen other groups where the numbers have been lower and other groups where they've actually been higher. I was in deep in the Darien Gap, right where the migrants come out of the jungle after about 6 days walking through the jungle with no food, no clean water, and facing all sorts of dangers along the way, and watching them like zombies, just one after the other, all day long, just hundreds of them coming out of the jungle, limping into this camp, some of them literally being carried in. Okay. And of those people coming in, all of them were telling me there's so many people dying out there. And I asked them, how many are dying? Some of them I talked to said, well, we had two people out of 40 or 50 that died. But one group I talked to said that they had 50 people that went in and only 10 came out. The bottom line is nobody really knows exactly how many are dying along the journey because they don't know how many are starting the journey, because they start from several different points along the way, and they get lost in this deep, dark Darien Gap jungle, and some of them take 2 days to get through, and some of them take 10 days to get through, and some of them never come out again. So they really don't know, but as best I can tell, again, I'm trying to narrow it down and follow one group all the way from the beginning to the end, and so far, they've lost 12 people, two of which were pregnant women, so let's say 14 out of about 41 people at the beginning. You just never know. But unfortunately, so many of the people that are coming now are bringing babies with them. And I'm talking about three-month-old babies, little infants going into the jungle. And of course, an infant is definitely not prepared to face the hardships of the Darien Gap. And so these babies are dying of dysentery and exposure and everything else. I saw one little three-month-old that made it through when we were in Bajo Chiquito, out in the Indian part of the jungle the other day. But he came through and he was completely naked. And the officials in Panama are telling us that they're having about two children a month come out of the Darien Gap without their parents because the parents died on the journey. And so these kids come stumbling out of the jungle or they come out with another adult that picked them up. And they don't know who this kid is, what his name is. They don't know what country he's from. He's not old enough to even tell you where he came from. And so Panama doesn't have a system in place to deal with this. They don't know what to do with these kids. So they put an ad in the paper and they try to take care of the kid as best they can. And after a couple of years, if nobody claims him, they give him a Panamanian name and send him off to school. So there's kids from Congo and Africa, different places, the Middle East that are now quote unquote Panamanian kids because Panama doesn't know what to do with these poor children. And this is all, I have to just keep repeating this. This is all a function of American policy. Nobody in their right mind would carry a three-month-old into the Darien Gap. but they're doing it because they're being told that you can skip the line and get right into the U.S. At this, if you have a baby, that baby is your golden ticket.
And that's what just boggles my mind. And we know why. Americans are busy. They're busy with a lot of nonsense, you know, and they get appalled every once in a while. My blood has been boiling since we talked last because what you just said there, this is a crisis that we, America, our politicians are creating. And I don't separate those two because we vote in these politicians. You know, I can't stand this all the time when people are like, oh, look what's happening here and there. You have the power. We still have the power to influence this. And this is 100% driven by a failed policy.
Well, like I mentioned yesterday, keep in mind that these migrants have been out of the country that they're supposedly fleeing, whether that's Haiti, Cuba, or Congo, for years, almost all of them. And what we're seeing is that there was a large backlog of migrants that were leaving their home countries, getting jobs in Ecuador, Chile, or someplace, and doing just fine. And so the question is, why are they coming right now? And the reason they're coming now, they will tell you, is because Joe Biden is president, and he told us the border was open. They'll tell you that's right to your face. And they don't even pretend that they're coming for humanitarian reasons or because they're fleeing persecution. They'll tell you, I'm coming because I can make more money in the U.S. And that I've been waiting for 4 years for Trump to get out of office so that I could come, which proves that policy does make a difference. Under Trump, the number of people coming through there slowed to an absolute trickle. But now it's a tidal wave because of public policy.
This is a fact. This is a statistical fact. They've been tracking these numbers for 30 years. And the administration's policies these last 4 years absolutely stemmed this tide. And again, we focus too much on the border, on the U.S. border. And this is where I do agree. Once that person is across the river, across whatever, you know, boundaries we've created for them, which is largely nothing in most of these places, once they're here, yes, it is our problem. It is something that we need to deal with. But the death and the destruction and the abuse that we are inviting upon these other people, to me, is absolutely unacceptable and devastating. Can you recap? So you're talking about what you've seen in this group of people. You're saying 1 in 7 deaths. What about the physical and sexual abuse that they're undergoing?
We've been tracking this now. I've been really focusing on this for about 3 months this time, but I've been reporting on this problem for decades. And there have always been people that made their way up to the United States through the Darien Gap. And it's just much worse now. And the makeup of people is worse because of all the pregnant women and babies we're seeing. What's happening is these people come up through South America. They're coming from, again, all over the world, dozens and dozens of countries, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Nepal, Syria, Turkey, you name it. And many of these are obviously bad places. They come to the Western Hemisphere through gateways that allow them in without a visa. That's Ecuador, Guyana, Brazil, countries like that. And then they make their way up to that isthmus that separates South America from North America, called the Darien Gap. And they just plunge into the jungle on foot. They're told by the smugglers that it'll take them a couple of days and not much more. And that's not true. It takes about 6 days the way most of the people go. I've been confronted by these smugglers as I've tried to walk into the jungle with the migrants. And they've come up and surrounded me and said, you're leaving or you're going to get hurt. And I didn't have Jeff Teagues with me, so I had to leave, because if I had you, I could have, well, I don't know. I think I can at least outrun you and leave you to their.
Exactly. leave the old guy. Yeah.
Leave the old broken guy. No, but so I, you know, these smugglers send them into the jungle, and they're facing hardships like I think most Americans can't even fathom. As a matter of fact, I was telling this one of the Haitians last night, I don't think 10% of Americans could even survive the walk through the jungle. We're just too soft. Haitians are pretty hardcore people because that's a pretty hardcore place. But Americans probably would not be able to make that walk. And so these Haitians plunge in there. They're used to going without food. They're used to sleeping on the ground. They're used to all that kind of discomfort. They can live without that. It's like ranger school, you know. But in the jungle, there are groups of, they're called maleantes, you know, just bad people who live in there because it's a totally lawless place. There's almost no influence of Panama or Colombia in the Darien Gap. And so these guys live in there and they do whatever they want. And so their migrants are walking along. We heard the story last night. They get ambushed by a group of guys with guns and they line everybody up and they say, drop everything you got, including your clothing. And they strip them naked. And then they go down the line to the women and they say, you look kind of nice. You go with him, you go with him, and you go with him. And they take everybody else sit down and wait, and they take them off in the bush and rape them. And then they let them come back. And they, in the meantime, other people have gone through all their belongings and taken whatever they wanted. And then they let them pick up and keep moving. This woman I was talking to last night said, the only thing I had left was a gold chain that my grandmother gave me around my neck. And I offered it to the guy so that he wouldn't rape my 15-year-old daughter. And he agreed. He said, okay, give me the chain and I'll protect your daughter and go. Just run, you know. And so her daughter didn't get raped because she gave that up. But the amount of sexual violence that's happening along the way is that virtually every woman who is anywhere near childbearing age is going to be sexually assaulted on the journey. That's just a fact.
Folks, if you're just tuning in, talking with an old friend, Chuck Holton, he's a freelance journalist. He travels to hot zones all across the globe. He's currently sitting down at the Darien Gap, which is a very dangerous crossing point, a choke point for these migrants that are coming to the U.S. Their next journey will take them through Mexico and then to the U.S. border. So you and I don't know if this is once a jungle expert, always a jungle expert. You're probably, vetting yourself, the fact that you live down in Panama and spent so much time down there. But, you know, we were trained to survive in the jungle. It is a tough place. As we're talking about this, I'm having flashbacks to the late 80s, early 90s of the jungle. It is just, and even that area around the Darien Gap, like I know that area. It is brutal. So that alone is mind-boggling to me. But the level of abuse, I want this to sink in for people, because here's what really pisses me off, man, is in order to make people care, we have to hit those touch points that scare them, right? Like you talk about, and what they called them on the border were the exotics. There's an official term, and I even forgot what it's called, these special cases where they're coming from.
SIA, special interest aliens.
There you go. The special interest aliens. Well, they call them exotics once they get, you know, the National Guard guys. And they're coming from Chechnya or the Middle East or Iran or China, you know. Yep. So we talk about these special interest aliens because there's the high likelihood that they're terrorists. So we talk about them and it hits this touch point of people. Ooh, you mean we have terrorists coming across the border? You know, and then we talk about how much it costs the U.S. It costs us $60,000 a year for these migrants. I mean, we talk about dollars. Oh, that's where my money's going. We talk about COVID. All these people are coming across without a COVID test. I can't even imagine how much COVID is coming into our country. So now you've got another group of people that's like, oh, wait a minute. We've got COVID coming into the country. But brother, how is it that we jump past the level of rape and murder that's happening? Mm-hmm. What is wrong with America where rape and murder doesn't hit a touch point for us, but the fear of COVID, terrorism, or something hurting my pocketbook is the one thing that makes Americans take action? What the heck is wrong with us?
I think that people... Very often, the thing that seems like the humanitarian thing to do ends up being just the opposite. And that's one of the ways that the left really tries to divide America is by saying, oh, those people who don't want to let in all the migrants, they're just horrible people that just, they don't care about humanity. And I think that when you really sit down and count the cost to humanity, now humanity being not just Americans, but to the actual people we're enticing to come to the United States, if we count the cost to all of us in a holistic way, what we'll see is that it is far too expensive. It is just a very, very broken way to get people to the United States, to get workers, or to give people a chance to get better. Think about this. If it costs American taxpayer, you know, again, according to the Federation for American Immigration Reform, it costs the American taxpayer about $61,000 a year for every migrant family that comes to the United States. That's in the form of state programs, federal programs, free health care, free medical, free education, things like that. There's no such thing in Latin America as free education. Even public education, most of the things in there have to be paid for by the families. So that's a big deal for them to come to the U.S. and be able to just send their kids to school. But it does cost the American taxpayer something for every kid that's in school, right? So you start counting up that cost. If we really cared about these people, why wouldn't it be smarter for us to try to come up with ways of helping them stay where they are and make their lives better there? Let's try to make the whole world a better place and not make the whole world America. Let me just give you an example of this, okay? The left likes to talk about family separation and the terrible policies of the last administration that separated families at the border when they would show up with a kid and we couldn't prove that it belonged to them or something, right? But let me tell you about the true family separation. The true family separation happens when a father in Guatemala says to his wife, hey, I'm making 20 bucks a day here in Guatemala. I could make 20 bucks an hour if I go to the United States. So in order to make more money, because more money is what we really need to make us happy, I'm going to take one of our four children and I'm going to make this dangerous 2,000-mile trek to the U.S. southern border. And I'm going to apply for asylum, quote unquote, there, which is going to take about 3 years for me to get a court date. But then during that time, I'll work, I'll send money home. And then as soon as I can, I'll bring the rest of the family up to be with me. Well, here's what happens in reality. If they survive the journey, and that's a big if, they get to the United States, they get given a court date 3 years in the future for an asylum hearing that they're not going to be given asylum for. But then they're allowed to go free in the United States. And so dad goes and gets a job as an Uber driver or a construction worker, starts sending money home. But what happens when, I mean, you've been deployed away from your family. You know how hard it is to be apart from your loved ones for 8, 9, 10 months. Imagine being gone for 3 years or more. What happens very often is we see these guys end up getting a girlfriend and end up having another family in the United States. And then all of a sudden that money dries up in Guatemala and the wife is left with a half-built mansion and no husband and no money and one of her kids is gone. That's the true family separation. And it's all due to U.S. policy, which entices them to come to the U.S. instead of trying to make a go of it where they are, or in the worst case, move to another place that isn't as dangerous. I mean, look, I've been all over Latin America, been all over Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, you name it. And yes, there are dangerous places that you wouldn't want to live in Guatemala, but there are also very nice places in Guatemala. And if you are in one of those dangerous places, isn't it easier for you to pick up and move to a safer place within Guatemala than to go to the United States? Of course it is.
Without enduring the trauma along the way.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the other thing too, when, you know, all things possible, we deal with trauma. And that's the thing that also blows me away is you have these migrants that are now settling inside the United States. And again, this is where I think Americans, they don't understand. This person that's Hispanic or African or whatever, they still suffer trauma just like us. So now you've got this young girl who lost three of the four people in her family. She was raped four, five, six times on her way here. And now she's living in Boston or Chicago or wherever else. At what point does this young lady have an opportunity to deal with the trauma that she went through? Mm-hmm. You know? So I'll tell you what, Chuck, you know, we're in the process right now of looking at the rest of the year for us. We really felt a call from God to do something about this on the border. And I've literally been kind of writing out the plans and looking at all this. And my heart was kind of getting soft. I was kind of, you know, we just came back from Iraq. There's plenty to do there. There's plenty to do in all different places. But you have 100% reinvigorated that ATP has got to do something about this. And what I'm talking about specifically is when these people make it to the United States, who is trying to give them some relief of this trauma and offer them some hope? Because here's the other piece that we've been seeing that Border Patrol told us. I don't know what the stats are, but many of these young men and women, once they get to the US and they're in these holding facilities, they're killing themselves. Mm-hmm. And what are they killing themselves for? They crossed the finish line. They're in the land of the free. They're killing themselves for what they had to endure to get here. And that is absolutely staggering to me.
Well, and I think that when any time, you know, you and I both know this, anytime we as human beings start to convince ourselves that what really is going to fix our problems is more money, we are going to be disappointed when we get there. That's barking up the wrong tree. And 99.999% of these migrants are coming to the United States simply for more money. They're enduring all that hardship, not to escape persecution, but to get more money. And when they get to the U.S. and find out that, number one, the U.S. is tremendously expensive. You think that $15 an hour is going to be great until you have to pay $8 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And, by the way, pay about half of what you make back to the U.S. government in one form or another. These are people who don't understand all those complexities, and they get to the U.S. I mean, I've had them tell me in the U.S. and say, I didn't realize what I was giving up when I left my home country, that simplicity of living out in the, you know, in the in a rural area of Guatemala actually was kind of nice. I was surrounded by, I mean, I've got a friend in Panama, one of my best friends in Panama. He's 70 years old. He's never had electricity until about a year ago. He was born on the piece of property where he lives. He farms about 20 acres with a machete and a hoe. He's never paid a dollar of taxes. He's surrounded by a strong extended family, grandkids and, you know, everybody, and they all help each other. He grows and raises pretty much everything he needs on his property. And I tell him, Sebastian, you're the richest guy I know.
Yeah.
And he goes, what do you mean? I don't have any money. And I said, that's right. You don't need money. You got, there are so many people in the United States who work themselves to the bone for their entire lives to have the kind of a piece of property and just putter around and do what I want to do all day, which you've had all your life. You are a wealthy man, Sebastian. You don't have to go to the United States to do that. Let's develop leaders in the developing world and try to help people there, and then we can help them avoid the trauma altogether.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, it's amazing to me. We're already out of time again for our second show. So folks, if you are just hearing the tail end of this, this has been Chuck Holton. He is investigating the migrants that are traveling from all across the world, from Haiti. Specifically, he's looking at Haiti, Cuba, Africa. They're coming up through Panama. Their next step of their journey is through Mexico into the United States. He's validated a bunch of the things that we believe we figured out with ATP. So there's a lot of different things people can do. But, you know, one of the pieces that's always out there that folks shouldn't discount is financial contributions. So how do people support what you're doing? Where should we send them?
Well, they can just Google my name and find Patreon. You know, my show is called The Hot Zone, so patreon.com/hotzone. They can go to YouTube or PayPal, and you know, actually, you can go right onto Victor Marks' webpage, and I'm just looking up here, victormarks.com/hotzone, I believe is the link.
Yep.
And people can give directly through Victor Mark's webpage and make it tax deductible. And that gets sent right to me. And we try to take that money. And as I travel around the world and I meet people that are in dire straits, we try to make their lives a little bit better. We don't just make the news, we make it better for the people that we meet and try to show a little bit of God's love around the world in the process.
Yep. Like Chuck said, you can find him. Just Google Chuck Holton, H-O-L-T-O-N. You'll find a bunch of stuff come up on him there. You can also donate through victormarks.com/hotzone. We've had that link up and running for years now. That's how connected Chuck and ATP are. So, or if, you know, you just send it to ATP and say you want to get this to Chuck, it's that easy for all of us. Thank you for joining us today, Chuck. Thanks to all of you that have tuned in. Again, I'm Jeff Teagues, the Chief Operations Officer here at ATP. Thanks for joining us on this edition of the Victor Marks Show.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode. We'd love to stay connected with you and invite you to the conversation beyond this podcast. You can check out more of the work we're doing around the world at victormarks.com, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, all linked in the show notes. Be sure to drop us a comment in the review section if today's show has impacted you in any way, or if there's anything you'd like to hear more of. We're always encouraged to hear from you. Thanks for spending your time with us. Until next time.